Previously on Solve the World.
They were breaching into the new ride at Magical Kingdom. Jen would soon know the very secret she was cast to uncover. What a wonderful coincidence. Someone up there is looking after me, Jen thought. And her thoughts brought to mind a hazy figure telling her something important. A half-remembered phrase. With all your lungs. What on earth did that mean, and who said it to her? Jen couldn't comprehend where this memory came from, or what its center of gravity was. But the inflection in that phrase, with all your lungs, rang in Jen's mind as something with urgency, like something that mattered. This was it, the answer to all things.
Solve the World, a fictional adventure told in 100 episodes.
I've always called him names, keeps him in line.
Episode 70, Games Worth Playing. Don't think for 1 minute that the post-apocalypse is no fun. Despite what you've seen thus far, there's still lots of room for fun, even joy. Take, for instance, the children of Anmo. Besides the pressures of essentially working as slaves just to avoid banishment, children never abandoned their childrenness, which means, so to speak, that they play. Room Ball was the elite game of Anmo's orphans. That's Room Ball, spelled B-A-L-L, not to be confused with Roomba, the automated vacuum cleaner. Make no mistake, there were no Roombas at Anmo. Room Ball was something of a mix between baseball and dodgeball. The rules started out simple enough, but inevitably evolved into further and further nuances and complications. The basic premise of the sport was based off of Anmo's cacophonous lairs and rooms, yet confined feelings. The underground dwelling of Anmo seemed to go on and on without end, room after room, purpose after extended purpose. Yet, besides the greenhouse and the one major auditorium, every sanctuary at Anmo felt cramped. Simply put, there were too many souls for too small of places. If you busted down all the walls, most of the kids felt like there would be plenty of room. After all, that's what kids love most in their heart of hearts, right? Open space to run, sweat, spit, and be free. Room Ball was a way to make the smallness of each individual four-walled room feel important and marginally big. Both the field, I'm using air quotes when I say field here, and the number of players on a Room Ball team was completely variable. It constantly fluctuated from day to day, game to game, sometimes inning to inning. The setup is like this. The team on offense has a bat and one batter in the first room. Defense starts with three defenders in a room. In the beginning, the defense would pitch to the batter. This could never work. Kids can never decide on balls and strikes. Crybabies, quitters, and general madness always ensue. So, it came to pass as necessity that the offense pitches to itself. Once the batter hits the ball, there are no fouls. The batter immediately runs for the door. His or her aim is to try to get to the next room. If he can get to the next room before he or she is beamed with the ball, then the runner is considered safe. Play moves to the next room. The subsequent room again has three defenders and a new batter. Once the batter hits the ball in this room, both the current batter and the batter from the first room sprint like their lives depended on it to the next room. You see where this is going? If either runner gets beamed, that offensive player is out, and a new batter has to start in that room. Once three kids are beamed, you count the number of runners that didn't ever get hit by the ball, and that's your score for that inning. As you can imagine, if you play in enough rooms with enough kids, this turns into a running of the bulls, wherein you'll have 18 runners stampeding towards the door, often in already busy rooms. Like, take for instance the stationary bike room, or the Malingernian factory. It's chaos. Delightful chaos. The game, despite its weirdness and variability, is loads of fun. Scout Further always laughed. She wasn't the best batter, but she could run, and man alive, it was fun to be on defense. There's something truly life-affirming about beaming another kid in the back with a large bouncy ball. Of course, kids always got hurt. There were hurt ankles, hurt feelings, and the occasional accusation that you were trying to throw the ball at my family jewels, which of course was super off-limits. God save the queen. When Scout Further played room ball, the stress of her life went away. Everything went away. While playing, there was only ever room ball, and the world was lovely again, fun, and full of laughter. Fun isn't just for kids. Adults can have fun too. Monday evening, the last day of glass housing, Free Church partied in the streets. It was fine. More than fine, actually. The Elder Council completely endorsed it. Fire hydrants were pulled off, flooding the streets. Businesses set up laser and light shows. And the big smugly headquarters itself blared out techno beats throughout the evening. The streets were for partying. It's a funny thing, really, that the worse life gets, the more heartily the soul longs to dance, as if the dancing were some form of personal exorcism. Whatever the case, you should have been there. It was a party for the ages. That was Christchurch, New Zealand, after the outbreak of the Lonely Plague, after the nuclear bombast. After the glass house. That was Free Church. That was smuggling. This is Jennifer Dash. This is Atticus Further. This is A Submarine. Together. It wasn't so much that fun was being had, but rather that hope was being rekindled. The reasons were different for Jen and Atticus. For Atticus, the small flame of hope came at first with Jen's little self-exorcism ritual. It was just an exercise of show, of course. There was no magic in the black paste, no incantation prayed upon the confines of the shoebox. It was just a dumb little exercise in visual mechanics. But it worked. Religion may be 90% showing off, but sometimes it's the showing off that changes hearts. Belief is weird like that. The heart must be convinced long before the head has agency to move. 9 times out of 10... the head just confirms whatever facts the heart's already taken captive. Humans are weird like that. Hope for Atticus started that day with letting go, shrugging off both inappropriate and appropriate shame. Don't let it fool you, though. Forgiveness, no matter where it's aimed at, within or without, is a process. Atticus only began to forgive himself that day on the submarine. Each day after, he forgave himself again. A little more. Some of it was not fun at all. In order to forgive, you have to remember. You have to relive. Otherwise, you're merely forgiving a non-thought. Forgiving takes work. It takes time. Not all of those times are pleasant. Still, young Mr. Further was making progress. Being bedridden was a good stimulus to stay vigilant. Jen's plan, after all, was good. Save Scout. Who could be against that? The only reason not to be was guilt. Get rid of the guilt, and the Save Scout Squad is steamrolling soundly ahead. For Jen, hope came in the form of conversation. Since Mecca, real conversation had been noticeably lacking from her life. Marianne Margaret and smugly Esau were not the best travel companions. Up until her resumption back on American soil, Jen had had a sparkling ability and capacity to find people with whom to connect with. Since then, however, America, and seemingly everywhere else, had become inaccessible, mentally speaking. From the crooked police officer to Dahl Burden to even Joanna de Tocqueville, no one was connectable. Jen missed that. She'd had the benefit in times gone by of sharing company, breaking bread with geniuses and eminently charismatic personalities. Finally, now, with Atticus at hand, she had a compatriot. He was different now, sure. But wasn't everyone? They talked some, but mostly Jen read to him. She'd brought 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with her onto the submarine. For a while, though Atticus always insisted he liked her reading to him, there was little evidence to support this assertion. Then, finally, a line in the book made Atticus bowl over with laughter. Jen didn't particularly see the abject humor in the sentence, but Atticus's gut-busting crooning caused her to laugh too. First sympathetically, but you know how it goes. Once you start laughing, sometimes it just takes over. The matter got so serious, in fact, that Jen fell out of her seat, the muscles in her body refusing to work after so much laughter. The suspect line in Jules Verne's book was this: "Perfume is the soul of a flower, and sea flowers have no soul." Several of the guards rushed in to check on Jen, fearing that the noise they were hearing was Jen's mortal moans. After that moment, Jen and Atticus were able to have real, meaningful discussion. It served as an icebreaker. They talked about the book, the little nuggets of philosophy found within, and also they talked about their lives. Jen told Atticus that she met Betty, told him she was no nonsense, brave, strong, safe. She didn't tell him about the meat, though. Didn't want it to seem like Betty was in need of anything. And most certainly, Jen didn't want Atticus to start a Save Betty campaign. At least, not anytime soon. Then, all too quickly, the day came. They had surfaced, back on the shores of the New World, California. Atticus was not ready for adventure. Honestly, neither his body nor his mind could handle the trip. Julian, the security guard, and Jen were to make the great uranium-enriched air voyage. Strapped up in a hazmat suit, Jen felt like a cosmonaut. A vague memory of the Halloween cosmonaut suit in the magazine she picked out of Red Jeb's mail blazed in her mind. All things return, she thought. Smugly knew what he was doing. The elders equipped the submarine with a fully functional off-roading four-wheeler. Magical Kingdom was a good 20 miles inland, so this was no small feat. The interesting thing of it was that the submarine couldn't fit a full vehicle in any of its cabins, so it had to be assembled. Jen had never seen anything like it. The seats of the four-wheeler were made out of inflatables. The tires were stored independently in separate sections of the submarine, and the main engine itself was remarkably small. The day prior to landing, a 3D printer on board the submarine was used to print off a few extra pieces that helped bring the four-wheeler together. It took Julian about 90 minutes to assemble the whole thing on the sandy beaches of Los Angeles. If you were to picture a post-apocalyptic, post-nuclear blasted Los Angeles County, you'd probably picture something much worse than what Jen saw. She imagined that the whole horizon would be painted in chemical oranges, suggestive reds and browns. No, it was a bright, sunny day. Blue sky, yellow sun. Sure, some of the buildings they passed were blown out, fallen down. And true, no window anywhere seemed to be intact. But, for the most part, everything looked kinda the same. The highway was still there. The 5 met the 101 just where it always did. There was even traffic on the freeways, per usual. Only difference was, the cars on the 405 and the 5 were at a standstill not because it was rush hour, but because no car was moving at all. The county felt like a dream in that way. Everything's the same, but everything's different. Jen could feel it in her stomach. The soul of Los Angeles was gone. 20 miles inland, Magical Kingdom had a wall. This precipice surrounding the Catholic-flavored theme park was not there when Jen last roamed its corridors as the Queen of Egypt. The wall appeared to be primarily constructed with flattened cars, stacked one on top of another, at least 25 feet high. Julian and Jen slowed to a halt in the parking lot. both spacesuit-vested adventurers staring unblinking at the sign spray-painted across four cars in the middle of the bulwark. The sign read, "Help Lizard or Die."
Hey, what's it mean?
Julian said, a quiver caught in his throat.
Are there lizard people here?
I think I know what it means. From the corner of her eye, Jen caught the shimmying of a shadow.
Hey! Hey!
She called out to the mirage.
I need to speak to Liz!
What's the password?
The thing in the shadows cried back.
Hey, I don't know if this is such a good idea.
Shut up, Julian. Let me think.
What if we get it wrong? Look!
The mirage creature, docked somewhere atop the car-heaped wall, drew an arrow out, pointing a flame-addled cloth directly at the inflatable four-wheeler and its occupants.
It's gonna shoot that flaming arrow at us!
Just wait.
We gotta go. It's gonna blow us up, Jen.
Wait. Blake! William Blake! I think I got it.
Jen wiggled out of her passenger side seat. Julian was quick to follow. Better to not be sitting in the very combustible vehicle. Standing tall in her space suit, Jen rang out these words from William Blake, suddenly inspired, and filled up with a memory she'd long thought lost.
Can I see another woe, and not be in sorrow too? Can I see another's grief, and not seek for kind relief? Can I see a falling tear, and not feel my sorrow's share? Can a father see his child weep, nor be with sorrow filled? Can a mother sit and hear an infant groan, an infant fear? No, never can it be, never can it be. And can he who smiles on all hear the wren with sorrow small, hear the small bird's grief and care, hear the woes that infants bear, and not sit beside the nest, pouring pity in their breast, and not sit the cradle near, weeping tear on infant's tear, and not sit both night and day, weeping all our tears away? Oh no, never can it be, never can it be. He doth give his joy to all, he becomes an infant small, he becomes a man of woe, he doth feel the sorrow too. Think not thou canst sigh a sigh, and thy maker is not by. Think not thou canst weep a tear, and thy maker is not near. Oh, he gives to us his joy, that our grief he may destroy. Till our grief is fled and gone, he doth sit by us and moan.
The creature ducked, pulled its flaming arrow out of view. Jen smiled at Julian. As she smiled, the four-wheeler burst into flames. The creature had moved, finding a better angle to light the inflatable on fire.
Stop!
A cry from the deep within the walls.
Let them in!
Like clockwork, a pile of cars suddenly tilted on their axes. Busted car, drawbridge. From the space within, at the center of the opening, a gargoyle ran towards Jen, arms outstretched.
Jennifer!
Liz!
Ironically, it was the newest ride of Magical Kingdom, its last, the one that Jennifer Dash ratted out the secrets of to Lilith Babbitt, that Lizard was able to give sanctuary to the travelers within. Lizard explained that Heaven Above, the ride that recreated St. Anthony's torment and life and subsequent ascension into the stars, was the most insulated building on the premises. A little handiwork and Lizard's minions were able to make it airtight. Therefore, in Lizard's company and free from the fear of radiation, Jen and Julian shrugged off their hazmat suits.
You remembered Blake!
Of course, you taught me well.
I've heard many songs of innocence since then. Jennifer, did you know?
How could I?
Bambit soared into the sky.
I know.
Did you?
No.
Where did you go?
I'm not sure.
What's your best guess?
I think I just went into my own mind. Somewhere deeper than dreams? I think I visited my subconscious. Lizard shook her bulbous, elephantine head.
No. No.
No? Jen said with a grin. Half of her effort was focused not on answering Liz's questions, but on looking at her without grimacing. She'd forgotten how unfortunate a visage Lizard maintained.
I always loved you,
the ruler of the new, not-so-magical kingdom declared. I know.
But now, I found an answer.
Lizard pivoted toward the back hatch of the room.
Cheryl, come here.
Out of the shadows, a thing mopped toward Lizard. If it was human, Jen couldn't tell. It came close, bent down, and pushed its featureless face into Lizard's. It was as if you took a square, or a rectangle, and suddenly said, "Be alive, geometric figure." For there was absolutely nothing about Cheryl that looked like a human. She, it, whatever, had no features. It was, in a very frightening way, featureless.
You didn't talk to your subconscious. You talked to your soul.
Is that who... this is? Jen motioned to Cheryl. Without notice, Julian vomited. Flecks of his upheaval landed on the animated rectangle. I'm sorry, Julian choked out. He started to offer a hand to Cheryl, wanting to help undo his supremely embarrassing accident, but he recoiled his hand, instinctively feeling like touching it, Cheryl, might infect him.
Go. Clean your beautiful self up,
Lizard said, and lovingly patted it on the... head?
But I've grown to love Cheryl very deeply. All this time, I've always wanted a way out. I've wanted to find a way through my disease. Now, I don't need to. I've realized that vanity attacks even the ugliest of us. The poor are the greediest and most selfish people on Earth. So, my ugliness shaded me from the truth.
What truth?
I am infinite.
Excuse me? Did you say infinite? Huh?
Infinite. My spirit goes on forever. All things are a part of me. To go deeper is to search only myself.
Cheryl is a part of you, Jen said. She found this obviously hard to believe. Did Lizard, genius mind that she was, somehow detach her soul from herself? That would explain the inhumaneness of the rectangle. That idea, though, is psychobabble. People can't do that, right? Not in real life. People don't make weird rectangle clones of their souls. Right? Not on this side of paradise.
Cheryl was a beautiful woman, but radiation got to her. Radiation plus all the plastic surgery she had before. The bombs.
Julian interjected. You're saying that's what happens if you get a facelift?
A confluence of realities changed Cheryl's image,
Lizard said almost offhandedly, trying to pry Julian out of the conversation.
Jennifer, I know the secret.
Lizard leaned in toward Jen, so Jen followed suit. What is it?
There are gods. Many gods. All we are is their reflection.
How do you know?
I've seen the infinite.
Oh, what's it like? Jen asked, not knowing how to respond to such a statement as that.
It's cold, Jen. Feels cold.
Oh, you don't happen to have the Croatoan, do you? I've been looking for it. That's kind of why we're here. A dreadful belly laugh from Lizard.
I cared about the book too. Once upon a time, I even read its pages.
You did? Hey, where is it, lady? Julian butted in.
After Lilith did her thing, I was filled with envy, jealousy. I wanted to do it too. I tracked the book down. She left it for you to find.
She did? Where? Lizard looked up.
Right here, in this room.
How'd you know to look for here?
I didn't, at first. I just retraced your steps. Figured if Babbitt wanted you to have it, she'd leave it somewhere you were.
Oh, so may I have it now?
I gave it away.
Why? Well, Julian and Jen responded simultaneously.
I read its secrets. Learned everything I needed to learn.
You didn't want to follow Lilith?
I know where she is.
You do?
Yes. I'm not ready to go there.
And where is there? Lizard looked up again.
Heaven, Jen. Heaven. To be reunited with the gods.
So the book, now, Julian prodded.
I gave it to your friend.
Who? What friend?
Mrs. Moose.
Jen smiled at Julian. And she has it now?
That's her business.
Hey, can we borrow a car?
On their way out, Jen and Julian were surprised to learn that Cheryl wasn't the only faceless rectangle manning the decks of Magical Kingdom. There were at least a dozen others, all of which Lizard appeared to be quite friendly with. Very friendly with. Before they finally got going in their new VW Beetle, Jen asked one more question of Lizard.
Do you know where Lex is?
Last I heard, she was headed to that island you two went to.
Pishtaco's Island?
No. The other one. The one we picked you up on.
Headed north, zigzagging through standstill traffic at over 50 miles per hour, Julian said,
I thought that lizard lady was the most disgusting thing I ever saw. But then, those other things. I didn't know radiation could do that.
I guess Lizard found a way to win the game. You know, she always wanted to transcend. Looks like instead of transcending herself, you know, changing her own body or dying or doing what Lilith did, she just surrounded herself with changed people. I guess for her, that's better than heaven. Julian didn't have an answer to that, and neither do we. Jennifer Dash will never again meet Lizard face to face. At this point, Elizabeth Schumacher exits our story, never to be seen or heard from again. As far as we know, she still rules Magical Kingdom, infinitely content to snuggle up to her rectangular friends. I got an interesting quote for you. It goes something like this. Jen Dash is a strong, independent woman and none of her suitors deserve her, leading me to believe she should be shipped only with herself. That is a quote from James, a longtime fan and listener to Solve the World. He did something that very few others of you have done. He took my advice last week and wrote a Wikia entry on Solve the World's Wikia page. He did one for Leviathan. Thank you, James. In return, I told him I would give him a one-sentence quote that I would read at the end of today's episode. If you want a one-sentence shout-out at the end of next week's episode, go to solvetheworld.wikia.com and write an entry on pretty much anything in the Solve the World universe. Shoot me an email once you've done that, as long as it's, you know, more than like a one-sentence article. And in return, I'll give you a quote about pretty much anything, as long as it's not, like, explicit or racist or something like that, at the end of next week's episode, okay? That's a little carrot at the end of the stick for you to go add to that Wikia page. This episode, along with every other episode of Solve the World, utilized sound effects and music that are found under Creative Commons licenses. If you want to see full attribution of those sounds and music, go to our show notes page at DanteStack.com. Thanks for listening, guys. Hopefully I'll get the chance to do some more Billboard shoutouts for you at the end of next week's episode. See ya!